Zeuxippus then took up the point. Then will the discussion remain incomplete because of him, and shall we be afraid to go on speaking against Epicurus? Not at all, I said. For, as Empedocles says, it is good to hear twice what needs to be said. So we must call on Theon again. I do not think he was absent when this was discussed before, and besides, he is young and need not fear being called to account by the young for forgetting. Theon, as though compelled, said, Well, if it is decided that I should do this, I will not imitate you, Aristodemus, for you were afraid to state his arguments, whereas I will use your own. You seem to me right in dividing mankind into three classes, the unjust and wicked, second, the many and the ordinary, and third, the decent and sensible. Now the unjust and wicked, fearing the judgments and punishments in Hades and afraid to do wrong, and for this reason keeping themselves more quiet, will live more pleasantly and with less disturbance. For Epicurus thinks that men should be restrained from injustice by nothing other than fear of punishment. So superstition must actually be heaped upon such people, and the terrors and chasms and fears and suspicions from heaven and earth must be stirred up against them, if they are to be struck with fear and thereby become more decent and gentle. For it profits them more to refrain from injustice out of fear of what comes after death, than, by doing wrong, to live their life insecurely and in constant dread. But for the majority, even apart from fear about what is in Hades, the hope born of the myth-like notion of eternity and the longing to exist, which is the oldest and greatest of all desires, surpass in pleasure and sweetness that childish dread. That is why, even when they lose children, wives, and friends, people would rather that the dead still exist somewhere and continue on, suffering hardship, than that they be utterly removed, destroyed, and become nothing at all. And they gladly hear and use the words, the dying man departs and passes on, and whatever else signifies that death is a change in the soul's condition and not its destruction, and they speak in this way. Yet even there I will remember my dear companion. And, what shall I say to Hector or to your aged husband on your behalf? And from this turn of thought comes the practice of burying with the dead their accustomed weapons, vessels, and clothing. And as Minos did for Glaucus, Cretan flutes, and the limbs of a dappled fawn, burying these along with the dead brings them comfort. And if it seems that the dead ask for or long for something, people are glad to give it, just as Periander burned his wife's jewelry along with her, since she seemed to need it and said she was cold. Figures like Aeacus, Ascalaphus, and the rivers of Acheron do not disturb them very much, since to those who delight in such things people have assigned choruses, theaters, and every kind of music once they have passed on. But everyone dreads that face of death which is fearful, grim, and dark, the face of unconsciousness, forgetfulness, and unknowing. They are troubled and cannot bear it when it is said of someone, he has perished, he has been destroyed. He is no more, as though what follows were. He will lie in the deep-wooded earth, having no share in banquets, the lyre, or the all-delightful sound of flutes, and a man's soul cannot be seized or captured to come back again once it has passed the barrier of his teeth. In just this way, those who say things like, we have been born once, and it is not possible to be born twice, and for eternity we must no longer exist, deal themselves a fatal blow in advance. For, disdaining the present as something small, or rather as nothing at all compared with the whole of things, they let it pass by unenjoyed, and they grow careless of virtue and action, becoming despondent and contemptuous of themselves, as if they were creatures of a day, unstable, and born for nothing of any worth. For the saying that, what is dissolved has no sensation, and what has no sensation is nothing to us, does not remove the fear of death but, as it were, adds a proof of it. For this very thing is what nature fears, the dissolution of the soul into something that neither thinks nor perceives, so that you all become water and earth. And Epicurus, by turning this dissolution into a scattering into void and atoms, cuts off the hope of immortality even more completely. Because of this hope, I would almost say that all men and women are eager to be torn apart by Cerberus and carried into the unfathomable pit, just so that they may remain in existence and not be utterly destroyed. And yet, as I said, not very many people fear these particular things, since they are the doctrines and mythical tales of mothers and nurses. And those who do fear them believe, in turn, that certain initiations and purifications help, by which, once purified, They will spend their time in Hades playing and dancing in places that have light, pure air, and sound. But it is the deprivation of life itself that troubles both young and old alike. For, as Euripides says, we are shown to be unhappily in love with whatever it is that gleams here upon the earth. Nor do we hear without pain and distress the words, so speaking, the far-shining, immortal face of Swift-Horsed Day left him. Therefore, along with the belief in immortality, they destroy the sweetest and greatest hopes of most people. What then do we suppose is the case for good people who have lived piously and justly, who expect no evil, but rather the fairest and most divine things? For in the first place, athletes do not receive the crown while still competing, but after they have competed and won. In the same way, believing that the prizes of victory in life belong to the good only after life, they take a wonderful pride in their virtue in view of those hopes, among which is the hope of seeing those who now behave insolently because of wealth and power, and who foolishly mock their betters, pay a fitting penalty. Then, too, no one who longs for truth and for the vision of reality has ever satisfied himself with it fully in this life, using as he does a reasoning faculty that is moist and disturbed, as if through a mist or cloud cast by the body. But instead, looking upward like a bird as though about to fly out of the body into something great and bright, they make the soul trim and light, freed from mortal things, by using philosophy as a practice of dying. So great and truly perfect a good do they consider death to be, since there the soul will live a true life, whereas now it lives not in waking reality, but experiences things like dreams. If then, the memory of a dead friend is sweet from every point of view, as Epicurus said, one may already grasp how great a joy such people deprive themselves of, supposing that they receive and pursue only phantoms and images of their dead companions, things with neither mind nor sensation, while not expecting truly to be with their beloved father and mother again, or to see a good wife somewhere, and having no hope of that companionship and affection which belongs to those who hold the same beliefs about the soul as Pythagoras, Plato, and Homer. Homer has shown what an experience like theirs is. He threw down a phantom of Aeneas amid the fighters as though he were dead, and then later revealed the man himself, coming alive and unharmed, possessed of noble might, to his friends, and they rejoiced, he says, and letting go of the phantom, they embraced him. So too we, when reason shows that it is possible truly to meet with the dead. And for the one who loves to touch and be together with the very thinking and loving part of the beloved, should not remain like those unable even to cast off all the images and outer husks, in which they persist grieving and suffering emptily. Apart from this, those who regard death as the beginning of a different, better life take more pleasure even when their present circumstances are good, since they look forward to something greater. And if things here do not turn out as they wish, they are not greatly distressed, but rather their hopes for the good and beautiful things after death, bringing immeasurable pleasures and expectations, erase and wipe away every deficiency and every setback of the soul, as though the soul, on a journey, or rather on a brief detour from its journey, bore what it encountered easily and with moderation. But for those for whom life ends in unconsciousness and dissolution, death, bringing not a change from evils but also a loss of goods, is painful to both kinds of people, yet more so to the fortunate than to those who live in hardship. For from the latter it cuts off only the uncertain hope of faring better, but from the former it takes away a sure good, namely living pleasantly. And just as, I think, drugs that are not beneficial but merely necessary, while not relieving the sick, wear down and harm the healthy, so too the doctrine of Epicurus, to those who live wretchedly, promises the dissolution and destruction of the soul as no fortunate end. While for the wise and prudent, teeming with good things, it altogether cuts short their good cheer, turning their existence from a blessed life into not living and not being at all. It is clear at once, then, that the very thought of the loss of goods is naturally painful, in proportion as sure hopes and present enjoyments give pleasure. Nevertheless, they also say that the removal of the suspicion of endless and unending evils leaves them the surest and sweetest good, namely, the very thought of having been released, and that this is what Epicurus' doctrine does, fixing the fear of death upon the dissolution of the soul. If, then, release from the expectation of unending evils is most pleasant, How is it not painful to be deprived of the hope of eternal goods and to lose the highest happiness? For not being is a good to neither kind of person, but is contrary to nature and alien to all existing things. But those from whom death's evil removes the evils of life have, as it were, unconsciousness itself as a comfort, as if they were escaping something. Whereas, on the contrary, those for whom the change is from good things to nothing see the most fearful of ends, one in which their happiness will cease. For nature does not fear unconsciousness as the beginning of something else, but because it is a deprivation of present goods. For that which becomes nothing to us, only by the removal of everything that is ours is, by the very conception, already something to us. And unconsciousness does not pain those who no longer exist at that later time, but rather those who now exist, as they are being plunged by it into non-existence, and yet, even so, are unwilling to be extinguished. That is why it was not Cerberus or Cocytus that made the fear of death boundless, but the threat of not existing, which offers those who have perished no possibility of changing back into existence. For it is not possible to be born twice, and for eternity one must not be, as Epicurus says. For if not being is the limit of being, and this limit is itself unending and unchangeable, then the deprivation of good things turns out to be an eternal evil, an unconsciousness that will never cease. And Herodotus was wiser when he said that God, having given life a taste of sweetness, shows himself to be envious in it, especially to those who seem to be happy, for whom pleasure is a bait of pain, since they taste what they will be deprived of. For what joy or enjoyment or exuberance would not be knocked down and brought low by the thought, constantly recurring, of the soul pouring itself out, as it were, into the vast, boundless sea, for those who place the good and blessed life in pleasure? And if, indeed, as Epicurus himself thinks, most people happen to perish in pain, then the fear of death is altogether beyond consolation, leading through evils to the deprivation of good things. And against these points, they will not tire of fighting and forcing all people to consider the avoidance of evils a good, but to no longer regard the deprivation of goods as an evil. Yet this much they admit: that death holds no hope and no joy, but that all that is pleasant and good has been cut off. At just the time when those who think the soul is imperishable and indestructible expect many fine, great, and divine things, or expect the soul to circle through long periods of time, now on earth, now in heaven, until it is dissolved together with the cosmos, kindled into intelligent fire along with the sun and moon. Such a vast region of so many pleasures Epicurus cuts away. And, since the hopes and favors coming from the gods have been removed, as has been said, blinding the love of learning that belongs to the contemplative part and the love of honor that belongs to the practical part, he has compressed and cast down our nature into something altogether narrow and not even pure, the soul's rejoicing that is fixed on the flesh, as though it had no greater good than the mere avoidance of evil.